this presentation, the minister is up here. Honorable Richard Baloyi, who's going to have a presentation. Honorable Nkechi Maitz, my apologies. He's always with the committee most of the time. Now we're starting to change even the title. Dr. Nkechi Maitz is here with us today as well, together with all the delegations from the Public Service Commission. We do have the Auditor General as well. I'm sure in the future we'll be making these dates and starting to call you Honorable because we'll be working with you much more. And Lachman is here and will be also taking us through. I can see all Honorable Members are also here. We will be joined by other committees as it was indicated in the past meeting because this is an ongoing activity of anti-corruption and we do have some lecturers from, I'm sure it's University of Cape Town, who are part of us here, and all other people who have joined the committee, you are all welcome. And we're looking forward as well to a successful day as we are dealing with anti-corruption. It is a program that started on the 3rd of November. It's going to be an ongoing program. This is part of Parliament on its oversight to amplify the area of anti-corruption and to ensure that we do our best in terms of our work to make sure that we don't lose money for wrong reasons, but the money goes to the overall objectives that government has committed itself to, which are very key to the people out there. And therefore, part of this program, part of this committee work, part of the oversight of Parliament, is to ensure that we make sure that all the resources and all what government is planning to do, it's done appropriately in order to benefit our people and to make sure that there's progress in the democracy that we're nurturing in this country. I will therefore start with a brief apology, some apologies that we have in front of us so that we can be able to proceed in terms of our quorum. Okay, there's quite a number of them. I'll give the whole outline a bit later. And I'll also outline what is going to happen in terms of the program. Like I've indicated that we've got Public Service Commission, Auditor General, the department. We will request, when we start, we'll request the minister to give an overview. Like I indicated, as it started last week, on the 3rd of November, we'll have an overview of our anti-corruption program, what the government is doing, areas of focus, how best can government deal with the areas of corruption and ensure that we stabilize government. So it will be the minister who will start first. The next presentation will be from the Public Service Commission, and that will be, Public Service Commission won't be doing wholesome presentation because we did get a presentation that outlines areas that relate to corruption from government on the bed. So they'll be zooming in particular activities and they'll be looking with a non-compliant with disclosure, you know, in terms of the disclosure framework. So we're starting to zoom into particular areas rather than just being broad and talking generally about the corruption practices. As you know, that there are close to 36 areas that had came before this parliament on different committee work that different committees are doing, which the research has been able to pull them out. And 36 corruption practices had been reported to this parliament in a number of other areas and in various ways. And therefore, as parliament, we are definitely going to go through each area in terms of how best can we clean out this corruption on our oversight work. So today we'll be zooming into the irregularities on expenditures. We'll be zooming into the non-disclosure framework because also it has its relation on this malpractice that involves corruption. So after the Public Service Commission, it will be the Auditor General on the irregular expenditures, and therefore we'll do the summary. But we are not going to end up here. This program is going to go out there. As members of Parliament, you know, even if they say Parliament is on recess or has resumed, we still do work. We are going to embark on oversight work on those areas. We are going to be calling the department to evaluate progress in terms of the areas that are raised, because our intention, the overall intention, is to see that areas, all the areas we've identified, cleaned out in terms of corruption. Because if we don't really keep this virus of corruption, it's the one that is going to destroy government completely. So I am, at this point in time, will request Minister Honorable Baloyi to give us an overview in a brief summary, and then we will therefore proceed to Public Service Commission.
How much time, Chairperson?
It will find to.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks to honorable members of the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration. Good morning, honorable Chairperson of the Public Service Commission, Dr. Mgijima, the Office of the AG, all senior public servants present here, the DG of Public Service Commission and the DG of TPSA. We, maybe Chair, if you don't mind. Having observed all protocols, Chairperson, as we have indicated, that this is an ongoing discussion arranged by the Portfolio Committee to deal with issues related to our fight against corruption, and requested that I do an overview. I'll do that in part of the contribution in this debate. As a government, we are committed to good governance. We are committed to a clean administration. We are committed to ensure that this good governance and this clean administration is meant to make sure that we maximize efforts to make sure that the resources that we have in the country are channeled towards addressing the key needs of the people, priority needs of the people. Because we said ours is government of the people, responsive to the needs of the people. So good governance is what we stand for. We then identify some challenges in the area or in the journey in and for good governance. And one of the challenges is the issue of corruption. So as the Portfolio Committee has provided this opportunity for us to talk about this thing, it will be proper for us to indicate that we look at corruption in terms of how it manifests itself. And we're looking at the a triangle relationship in the area of corruption. And that triangle relationship, on the one leg of the triangle, you find the corruptors. On the other leg, you find the corruptees. And on the third leg, you find the environment. These are three legs of one triangle that as we fight corruption, we then say we need to make sure that we break these legs. You need an environment that is conducive for you to apply your policies. We said as this government that ours is zero tolerance on corruption. So you are then saying the environment should not give space for any special community in the area of corruptors to exist and corrupt the corruptees. So in our dealing with that, we actually make sure that that is what we take on board. We are also organized in an arrangement that you can explain through a triangle again. You have the Public Service Commission, which we say is the custodian of good governance. We know what the Public Service Commission, in terms of what the Constitution and the Public Service Commission Act says, they actually need to deal with issues related to good governance. We say they are a custodian of good governance. So if you're a custodian of good governance, when it comes to a situation where we're faced with challenges, we mobilize each other and then say, this is what we do. Now, on the other leg of the triangle of this corruption-fighting agent in government, you have the office of the Department or Minister of Public Service and Administration with the responsibility of being a facilitator that good governance should exist. And on the third leg of the triangle, you have the office of the head of the executive organ. That is the office of the president. That is the responsibility at the executive level to make sure that it is the authority. So you have a triangle of facilitator, of custodian, of authority in dealing with these issues. At times when we talk about our efforts of fighting corruption, it might appear like there are so many establishments, but one needs to locate that understanding within the role of each of the legs of the triangle. I'll come back to these two triangles, but let me indicate that as government, we came up with legislation. We came out with policies meant to fight the scourge of corruption. The Anti-Corruption Act, the Protected Disclosures Act that deals with the protection of whistleblowers, the National Anti-Corruption Strategy, which gave birth to the National Anti-Corruption Forum, where we are partnering not only as agents within government, but we also bring on board civil society and business. I'm sure you'll remember, Chair, ladies and gentlemen, that the National Anti-Corruption Forum was established. The Secretariat of the National Anti-Corruption Forum being the Public Service Commission for the role they play as an independent body. And we then see the chairpersonship of that forum rotates. The first chairperson of the forum when it was established was from civil society, and then came business, came government, and now the chair is business. So our government now is business. We are then saying that in terms of the resolutions that we take, in terms of the decisions that we take at each summit, we then work hard to make sure that the fight against corruption is not a fight for government only, it's a fight also for business, it's a fight also for civil society, for the triangle. The one leg of the triangle, actually all the three legs of the triangle of those forces that cause them or participate actively in corruption is actually bringing all of us into the picture. That's why they then say you can't have corrupt people if you don't have corruptors. And you may not have corrupt people and corruptors if the environment does not actually provide for such. So we are working hard, working together to deal with these issues, with all these sectors. So that is the National Anti-Corruption Forum, guided by the National Anti-Corruption Strategy, that then says we need to do 1, 2, 3. But forums and strategies and policies and legislation alone will not actually fight corruption. It takes people, actors there, to deal with these issues. That's why you then see, through the roles of the law enforcement agencies, we insist that the laws that were passed should be executed, to be implemented, and we then see also at the level of policies that we've decided upon, we'll need everybody to internalize. That's why you have business. Recently, Buddha organized their own sector-based conference focusing, amongst others, on issues of fighting corruption, where they then see in their areas they need to deal with this thing. So that is in as far as the National Anti-Corruption Forum and the strategy is concerned. Of course, in the area of dealing with implementing all these pieces of legislation, all these policies, all the resolutions and stuff like that, we will then see you need to keep on sharpening and resharpening your tools that you use. That is why, on an ongoing basis, the authority decides to strengthen the implementation. And it is on that basis that recently the president has established an interministerial committee, the IMC, on corruption. So that the IMC on corruption will then be, in as far as the implementation actually is established, to fast track the fight against corruption. So anyone who then says, yes, we are at this corner, we have established our own mechanisms for fighting corruption, this interministerial committee then says we want to take action. And of course, action has to be seen to be done and seen to be done at the coordinated level, hence that actually happened. At the level of facilitating a good governance, ensuring that there is good governance, as public service and administration, you have heard us recently talking about establishing a unit to deal with these issues of anti-corruption. So that what you then do is that you don't actually start at the level of corruption. You then say corruption, you know, is the highest form of breach of public service principles. But it starts right from integrity, it starts right from ethics. That is why we developed an ethics and integrity framework, which will then assist even other processes, even compliance with other processes. Like, for instance, the Public Service Commission is going to talk and understand about the area of disclosure. Now, if you deal with disclosure at public service level, like it happens in Parliament, we actually modeled our framework as public service from what Parliament is doing. You have the Joint Committee on Ethics and Members Interest, and the executive arm of that is the Office of the Registrar of Members Interest. So you know that there will always be a register that is published that talks about, I mean, the public rights of it can be accessed by any person who just know the simple basics as to how to access the register. And then establish that you have declared this, you have not declared that, and stuff like that. We are establishing the office of the ethics officer in the department, who will operate like the registrar here in Parliament, operate like the registrar of members' interests. then keep a register, working collaboratively with the Public Service Commission to make it a point that when with them say you disclose, it should not be at a point waiting until it's picked up that the person has not disclosed or what. The Ethics and Integrity Officer will be in a position to pick that up. Well, it's a privilege, it's an instruction, a chapter, and we respect the separation of powers and the relations thereof and who is superior between who and who. That's why we even talk to you in confidence about some of the things that will only unveil as we launch the unit. But I think you have a privileged position for us to talk about it. So you are looking at that. So that when you say you need to nip corruption at the bud, you should start in the mind of the person. You should deal with it as a psychological issue. You deal with it as an aspect of the culture of the public service. We are going to also unveil a charter. Some will then say, no, but this charter is just for the reputation of what we have. A charter for our public service. Will say, I, as you take that pledge in terms of the charter, you say, I shall do this. You recite like the Ten Commandments, but it does not end up there. These are issues that we have to even factor in our performance assessment to then say what you do, how you appear, your own attitude. These things taken on board as you deal with all these issues, because it is possible that the current situation to have a public servant who is actually a public charge, you know, a public charge in my mother's son, they say Gudumaya, is a person who, if you go to any section, if it is in a community, you go to any section, if they mention his name, you must know that things are not right. If they don't go at night because you will meet Joe, you must then know that Joe is not a good person. Now we may have such Joes, you call them public charge. You may have a public charge in a public service, but who every day when you go to marriage, year in, year out, when you go to performance assessment, this person always comes out with flying colors. We need to actually make sure that the attitude of each one of the people talk to the behavioral values that we expect. Are you internalizing the values of public administration in your operation and stuff like that? We spoke about Batupili. To what extent are we measuring compliance with the Batupili principle? Or you actually have a situation where they no, I'm sorry, just my phone is listening. Now we actually looking at that. Start from integrity, then we'll go to the issue of how we deal with the cases of discipline management. It takes so long to finalize, so protracted. It's like it's a journey. A journey not on a flight. A journey by a tractor from here to Messina in dealing with a disciplinary case takes forever. You put a day to them, this is a day for the disciplinary hearing. Just few days before that day, the public servant comes and says, please just postpone, I've got some commitment, postpone and postpone until it takes a year or two. You are dealing with a single case. Some of these cases, these people, as you deal with them, they are on suspension, but suspension with full pay. There is no edge. There is no drive for the case to be finalized. We are actually then saying we are dealing with these things. We have already received people saying, oh, no, it's fine, it's a good thing to do. Others say, no, you'll be violating the rights, you see, you'll be against the law. And we then say, there has never been a law that would be passed to be itself obstructing good governance. If such a law is there, we know where to go. We'll start here as this portfolio committee. Because this is where we go. will go to Parliament, and that we are told that there is a piece of legislation that actually is obstructing us in our journey for good governance, and will then prove to that law as to who is who between the law and ourselves. So that is, there were then things, these are some of the things that we are going to deal with. So the anti-corruption unit, as we introduce it, is then to walk the journey, is then for us to then be responsible to facilitate that there is good governance. Facilitating also means removing obstacles. Then we'll then be then saying that we're removing obstacles in our fight against corruption. So that is the issue. But as a government, we're then seeing that we're not alone in fighting the scourge of corruption. I've spoken about the partnership we developed with civil society, with business. But also, we are engaging beyond, even beyond our borders. You know very well that we are treated to the instrument of peer review in the continent, the APRS. We allow ourselves to be reviewed by our peers. You know that we went through the process of review in 2007. And you know that one of the certain issues they raised that we should pay attention to is the issue of corruption. And we are working on that to address these issues, not only for compliance or to appear to be seen to be responding to what our peers have said, but because corruption is an obstacle to good governance. We are even assisting our peers. You know very well that in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, I'm raising this because I think there is a parliamentary question that I will answer in no time. I'm answering it before it's raised, so that even if it doesn't come, you see, it will be a follow-up. It will be a follow-up question, quite interestingly. The DRC got interested in our national anti-corruption strategy. They then said, but how did you go about dealing with these issues? We facilitated the first summit in the DRC that produced a strategy modeled around our own anti-corruption strategy. I know it was captured in one of the media reports, I think last month. The Minister of Public Service was launching an anti-corruption strategy in the DRC. Well done, but charity begins at home, brother. That's what they reported. Yes, it's true. It's true. We then say our resolve is not to sell anything to anyone that does not work in our own, because if you do that, it's an indication that you're not a good brother. Now, not only at the continental level, you remember that our government acceded to the convention of the OECD countries, the Organization on Economic Cooperation and Development, which is an organization of the Rich Eight. Plus one, the OECD Convention on Bribery as the manifestation of corruption by officials on international business transactions. And having acceded to that, we allowed ourselves to be peer reviewed by countries. We were peer reviewed twice already. The last one being in February this year, where Slovenia and the United States of America were the lead assessors. They actually assess and establish and then find that, no, this is actually the things we need to pay attention to. That shows our commitment. We are committed, of course, to the UN Convention against the Corruption. So continental and the international bodies were committed to that, so that together with countries of the world, we may be in a position to continue in the journey to fight against corruption. When the journey will have run its course, when the fight will have been won, we are then seeing the environment that gives rise to corrupt practices in our country need to be turned around. We are then seeing corruptors should not find space. We are then seeing the corruptees will not be attracted to get into corruption. Because we must prove it, it must be seen to our children that corruption does not pay. Now, if it is not like that, if people may then say shortcuts to get rich quick is through corruption, that becomes the motivation for people to participate in. So in our fight, we are very clear that this is exactly how we are going forward. I did not talk about or factor in the triangle of the structures we have in government. I did not factor in our Chapter 9 institution. For obvious reasons that as this collective we know that we then said ours is upholding constitutional democracy. Ours is entrenching constitutional democracy. That's why we came with the Chapter 9 institution. So that theirs will be to make sure that they operate at that space in order to make sure that issues of corruption are dealt with nipping it at the nut, at the butt, so that we will not be reading about corruption. We know that the situation when we talk about corruption is a very serious issue. You look at the survey reports, the opinion makers will be and the surveyors will be giving this report and that report, and then they say you are not doing well, you are at number this, you are at number that. What we are then saying is zero tolerance to corruption. And we are saying we can only be partners for us to win in this fight. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Honorable Minister. Just to conclude on the issues of the apology. Okay, just to conclude on the issues of the apologies, I'll just state some apologies that came before us here. We have an apology from Chairperson on private members' legislation proposals. That is Honorable Trebejan. And then we've got another one from the Committee on Women, Youth and Persons with Disabilities who intended to be part of this meeting. Unfortunately, they had it last. We have an apology from Minister Chabani in the that is the Minister in the Presidency for and is the Minister for Performance, Monitoring and Evaluation. As you know, it's a Wednesday. Sometimes create problems, Honourable Valoy. Yeah, because it's a cabinet day. It's a cabinet day, so we just juggle around in terms of making sure that a minister also are able to be here. Even though we have an apology from the auditor general. Of South Africa's office, Mr. Jan van Stavrik, we still have Kivesh Lakman, who will be doing the presentation. So even though the vice chair, the office is represented. We have the last apology from Honorable Mohobi. I'm sure the members from this committee, Public Service Commission, would know the member, because when we do the collaboration of National Assembly and NCOP, we normally work with them, because we NCOP, from the side of the NCOP, Honorable Mkhobi is the one who deals with the matters that Public Service Commission deals with them. But it's unfortunate that, as you know, that NCOP has some engagements at this point in time. He couldn't be part of this meeting. Just to emphasize that collaboration is always looked into and will ensure that we work that way, so that we reinforce also existence as Parliament. Those were the apologies. And quite quickly, before we call Public Service Commission, that I'll expect they should be ready in the meantime, I will take through the meeting on issues that came before Parliament in terms of corruption practices. There is a consolidated outline. I'm sure most of you have got it in your packs, which I'm not going to detail, but just emphasize that when we do our oversight work normally in Parliament, quite a number of things come before us. Sometimes when we interact and engage with various reports, we discover that some of the areas that are reported to us have to do with corruption in one way or the other. And as a matter of fact, from the research side, all those areas across all committees were pulled together, as I indicated when we started. And I'll just take us through main issues that are there without necessarily detailing them, because this will be the part of an overall anti-corruption program for Parliament. And what actually came is that it starts from non-compliance with disclosure framework, hence we wanted Public Service Commission, even though they made an overall framework on anti-corruption last time on the third presenting to us, to zoom in particular to just non-compliance with disclosure today as they have prepared their outline. So we will be zooming per area and we'll be dealing with them, Honorable Baloyi, you know, where we want government to satisfy us that all areas that had been reported to us had been deemed by government. So we will zoom into per area. Hence the presentation by Public Service. The others, it was flouting of tender procedures. Of course, we talked to Auditor General about irregular patterns of expenditure. It will expand to other areas that are here, like maybe not supporting evidence of purchase, which came to our attention, maybe increase in costs of financial misconduct, which are also itemized here. There are also areas of fraud that had been reported to Parliament, which is part of the corruption practices. There is failure to sign performance agreements as well. There will be non-representativity, you know, because if there is no, we'll detail it once we come there. I don't want to, I actually said I'll just scan through. I won't give the elaborative details, but just to capture what is here. There is also non-representativity of the vulnerable groups in employment and in management. Maybe one can ask, is it it's a corruption practice? We'll talk about it once we arrive to those areas. There was collusion between doctors and officials to defraud the medical scheme. Vetting of personnel in tender processes, a long suspension with pay, and not decisive action taken. Honorable Minister made mention of such factors when he was also talking about some disciplinary procedures. Theft of firearms by officials, by police at police stations. Those are some of the things that are before us. Taking bribes to issue driver's licenses. There is also overstated curricula vitae, you know, as another common practice, and we will be coming to all those areas. There is also theft of movable assets, irregular disposal of state land, abuse of state vehicles, loss of case dockets, illegal release of detainees, influencing decision makers, e.g. senior officials, immigration officials, customs clerks, police officers, court clerks, supply chain officials, to get routine procedure followed quickly or not at all, skipping the lines, etc. You know, just say, well, there's also other people in front. Theft of warrant vouchers, irregular withdrawal of cases, fraudulent parole decisions, irregular issue of fishing permits and licenses, abalone-related corruption, unlawful benefiting from RDP housing subsidy, collusion and syndicate to alter bank details of compensation fund beneficiaries, nepotism regarding employment, promotion, and award of tenders, leaking and selling of examination papers, illegal receipt of social grants, fraudulent registration of births, fraudulent acquisition of passports and identity documents, fraudulent registration of deaths, marriages, and citizenship, fraudulent amendment of names, dates of birth and marital status, forged visa labels, unlawful release of illegal foreigners, fraudulent work and study permits, soliciting of bribes for access of a free service. All of those issues, as we talk, they're already in front of Parliament, and it's part of the work that Parliament will be doing, will be moving with various committees to ensure that all this work, we follow up with government and we find finality. Because if these practices are allowed to go on without anyone making an intervention, people will automatically think that they will be in a corruption mode, and they will think it's normal and it's natural to just be corrupt, and nobody will come and there won't be a follow-up. We are serious as this parliament on our oversight work to ensure that we clean those areas. And we believe that working in collaboration as all the committees of parliament will definitely make sure that we assist government to ensure that these areas are cleaned up. Okay, I'm sure the Public Service Commission is ready for their presentation. We are going to proceed to the Public Service Commission on the non-compliance with disclosure framework, which is also another pain on our side, because the law is very clear that it's straightforward. If it's not happening, we would follow up in terms of disciplinary action, which must be taken when it's supposed to be taken. If not taken, and then I think we should, together with government, try to find out why would we be lax about issues such as those. I therefore hand over to Dr. Mkidzima in public service.
Before we proceed, I just want to, the minister made a kind of very comprehensive statement at the beginning. I would like to ask some questions. The minister knows I always ask questions. He's expecting them. Will we have an opportunity after the presentation by the PEC, or can we ask questions now?
Okay. Mr. Gross, I thought we had a briefing last time. Perhaps it's just a summary. But if members feel they want to pose some questions, I'm sure you can proceed, Honourable Dreya, to ask your question. Honourable Mohali? Okay, what's the opinion of all members? Should we proceed?
I think let's set a procedure, then we group all the questions afterwards.
Only concern is, will the minister still be here? I know sometimes he's got pressing commitments and he has to leave. Will he still be here at the end of the presentation?
Okay. Oh yeah, also not why we got a commitment that today he's allocated time to us.
Even after the
Yeah, are you fine with that, Honourable Dreya, so that we proceed then to Public Service Commission? Dr. Mkidzima?
Chairperson, Honourable members of the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration, I recognize the Minister of Public Service and Administration, the Office of the Auditor General, the Director General of Public Service and Administration, and Director General of the Office of the Public Service Commission, representatives of institutions of higher learning, and hopefully all protocol is observed. As the Minister for Public Service and Administration pointed out, the Public Service Commission's commitment to fight corruption stems from its mandate to promote transparency, accountability, and integrity in the public service. On the 3rd of this month, November, we presented an overview on anti-corruption initiatives which are being undertaken by the Public Service Commission. Today, Chairperson, as you indicated, you have requested us to present in particular the financial disclosure framework. And to do that will be the Director General of the Office of the Public Service Commission, Mr. Dipova.
Thank you, Dr. Mkidzima, Honorable Chairperson of the Committee, Honorable Members, and the Honorable Minister for Public Service and Administration. This is a shorter presentation. Which is a follow-up to the presentation we made on the 3rd of November, as Dr. Mkidzima said, about 8 slides in the presentation. So just some introductory remarks and focus on trends in terms of senior managers overall, and then focusing specifically on directors general, and then some concluding remarks. The background has been made already by Dr. Mkidzima. that after the presentation of the set, we requested by the committee to make a presentation specifically focusing on disclosures, and therefore this builds on the presentation made on the 3rd of November. That slide there starts by giving trends in terms of the disclosures since 2000-2001. Honourable members will see that we've had the level of compliance in 2000-2001 being at 62%, going up to 66% to 2001-2002 to 82%, 2 and 3, and then going down to 3, 4. But overall, there has been a notable improvement since the introduction of the framework in 2000-2001, from 62% to the 83% that we're talking about. This is if you take overall compliance rate, not necessarily based on the due date. And the percentages under that table focus specifically on compliance by due date, which is the 31st of May. For 7, 8, 48%, 8, 9, 49%, 9, 10, 46%, which means that when you focus specifically on compliance by due date, the rates are still low. But overall, if you take compliance in terms of the whole year, the compliance levels are higher. This table just provides a breakdown once again in terms of compliance by due date. If you look at national departments, overall 42% by due date, and if you look at provinces, overall submitted submission by due date 52% higher. It's higher than the overall for national departments, and then the country total is 46%, which is what we've shown in the previous slide. But then you also just see the breakdown by province there. That province such as the Free State there was the lowest, 19% in terms of compliance by the due date. But a few other provinces doing fairly well, Limpopo 75%, Mpumalanga 70%, Northern Cape 80%, Western Cape 100%, and then the others falling below the 50% threshold. This slide just looks at overall compliance beyond the date, beyond the due date. So if you look at 9, 10 there, you see the compliance rate that we spoke about in the earlier slide, 83% overall. For national departments, 77%. For provinces, 92%. And the other information is just a breakdown by provinces. I just need to indicate that and it may not be in the slide that you have, that this has been updated, because it was initially reflecting as at 22nd of October, but because we're looking at up to 31st of October, the Northern Cape is 98%. But the overall aggregates do not change. For provinces, it remains 92%, and the total for the country remains 83%. But just to note there that the Northern Cape has gone up to 98%. The compliance rate for directors general here, focusing on by due date of 31st of May as well, that we received financial disclosures of only 15 out of the 41 directors general. And when we talk about the directors general here, we're talking specifically about DDs, not HODs overall. So the focus here is specifically in terms of the DGs at national level. The, at provincial level, the compliance rate was almost 100%, with the exception of the Northwest. The Northern Cape is also reflected here, but just to explain that the DG in the office of the Premier was appointed in an acting capacity in the Northern Cape, but the HOD had declared in an AER position as an HOD of a department. But at the time when they moved to the office of the Premier as the Director General, the post was vacant. So when we reflect the Northern Cape there, just to understand that dynamic, that the post was vacant, but the person who was in that post had declared earlier in their position as the head of another department, not as the DG of the office of the Premier. Just three critical things to emphasize, that they will be coming back to Parliament with the report that doesn't just look at the trends, but looks at the findings in terms of the scrutiny of the disclosure forms. We unfortunately, due to capacity constraints, not able to scrutinize all the forms that we receive. What we do is we take a 30% sample of the disclosure forms that have been submitted, so which means just under 3,000 SMS members. We take their forms and scrutinize them by looking at what they have disclosed relative to what appears on the CIPRO database, what they have disclosed as their properties relative to what the DEEDS office has captured, and look at the nature of the work that they do relative to the interest they have, and then produce a report that goes to the respective member of the executive. That is what that report will be doing. But just three critical points to emphasize here with the management of disclosures. One is just making sure that we hit 100% compliance rate, just the submission, because it's a very basic requirement, completing the forms and submitting them. That's a critical issue that requires the attention of the executive, so that we don't keep talking about 83%, 84%, and so on. But the second issue, in addition to just the submission, is making sure that what is inside the form is actually accurate, and there aren't things that are supposed to be disclosed but are not disclosed. As in cases where, for an example, somebody has a certain property that, according to the deeds office, is registered in their name but does not appear in their disclosure form, or in cases where, according to the CIPRO database, there is a company that a senior manager is associated with, but it's not reflected in the disclosure form. So that is the second critical issue, in addition to just submitting the disclosure form. The third and perhaps most important part is, once the form has been submitted, what happens to it? What happens during the course of the? Because even if you identify areas where there are potential conflicts of interest, the critical issue is managing those potential conflicts of interest during the course of the year, so that they do not then graduate into actual conflicts of interest. And that is a very critical matter. As we said in our presentation the other time, that a potential conflict of interest is not necessarily something to be ashamed of, but it's something you disclose so that it can be managed, and then it doesn't then graduate into an actual conflict of interest. That is the purpose of disclosing in the first place, so that the management of the potential conflict of interest, where they have been identified, can be done to avoid them graduating into actual conflicts of interest. This is our input for today, Honorable Chairman. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Public Service Commission. I can see Honorable Chair's hand is already up. Is there any other hand? Or maybe let's start with Honorable Chair. I'll take hands while we proceed.
Madam Chair, yes, I'm sorry to see that the Minister left during the presentation. That's exactly what I was worried about, that he won't be able to stay, and because I wanted to have some questions. We're not here to call the Public Service Commission to account. They provide us with information which we should then use to hold the executive to account. So I don't have questions to the Public Service Commission. They've given us information, and we say thank you very much for that. And this is a tool for us now to use in our oversight function to hold the executive to account. In other words, in our case, the minister. Now, seeing that I can't ask him a question because he's not here, I will make a comment, which maybe we can put to him when he comes back.
Can I request that maybe I'll end up with you? He's coming back. So that you can...
So not make my comment and then we... Oh.
Yeah, no, let's wait for him so that he can hear the comment directly from you. Let me take the other hand, but then immediately can, you know, actually proceed to your question on the choice. Honorable Willem, followed by Honorable Suka.
Thanks, Chairperson. I've also got the thing, I'd like to speak to the Minister as well. So we all want to speak to the Minister, so I think we can just move along. Thank you.
Okay, Honorable Suka.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me appreciate the presentation that has been presented here, because it adds on what has been given on to us on the third. But surely this presentation tells us that we need to give or to find ways of to those departments that are always lagging behind, because who are not submitting on time, that always gives a gap for this office to be found as if they are not doing their work. We need to find a way of giving them some tips thereof, because the responsibility by not submitting and having outstanding documentation or presentations when needed is a challenge for our government, especially when we look into the graph that is being here. We need to commend those provinces that adhere to the prescripts when needed, but surely we need to find a way of how best we give them some tips to those that are lagging behind, because you judge the performance of a province due to its administrative capacity and on entirely responding to those mandates that are needed. It's a pity. So I'm saying, Chairperson, we need to look into that. How best to give them some tips to be more firm to that. Secondly, because on page 7 of the presentation, the TSC received financial disclosure of only 15 Director General out of a total of 41. It means there is a serious challenge with that. Now, if the DGs of the various departments are not responding accordingly, that's why I'm saying we need to find a way of how do we strengthen our arms so that they respond timelessly when needed. Because now you don't know whether they are following what is expected of them or they are just left. It will be a sad day if our own department is not doing that. I hope they are not part of that. Because we can always monitor them through the quarterly reports that, when you speak financially, quarterly reports that they are supposed to submit, so that we can make some informed recommendations. Otherwise, Chairperson, that's my only concern for those to those provinces who are not timely responding to the instructions to be followed. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Suka. Back to you, Honourable Dreyer. Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, thank you. I'm glad to see the ministers back. Now I can talk to you. To you, Madam Chair, Minister, thank you very much for your remarks and so on. It was interesting to listen to what you plan to do and what you have done already. But I must confess a certain amount of cynicism on my part. And let me be straight with you. You talk about the charter that you want to unveil, and a ministerial task team, and so on. That's great, but we already have a code of conduct for public servants. We have an SMS handbook for the senior management service that prescribes, you know, certain things. We've got an anti-corruption coordinating committee. We've got an anti-corruption interministerial committee. We've got a national anti-corruption forum and a provincial anti-corruption forum. So we've got all the structures in place. So it's not the problem with structures and strategies, turnaround strategies. It's actually the implementation and the enforcement thereof. And then when we look at the presentation by the Public Service Commission today, then we see some worrying facts come to the fore. The trends in the submission of financial disclosures for this year, the financial book year, the due date is May, and I would suggest that that's the only date, so the only figures we look at, not for those who've submitted late, because they haven't complied. You've complied if you've submitted your disclosure by May, that's the due date. And then we find a figure of 46% that complied. In other words, more than half of managers did not comply, or in this case, Director General did not comply. And this figure is getting worse. The previous year it was 49, the previous year it was 48. So there was a slight up in 89, and then we declined again. So all these structures in place doesn't make a dent. But we look at the national figure, the provincial figure, then we say, this is not impossible. Some people manage, or some provinces manage to get it right. And I want to point to the Western Cape. They actually had a 100% submission by due date. So it's not an impossible task. There is a precedent. There's an example of some get it right. So I want to ask the minister that we don't need more
committees and task teams and charters and what have you. What we need is actual enforcement of what we already have. So those that have not submitted their financial disclosures by due date, what happens to them? It surely it's written into the performance contract. That's one of the performance, that's one of the requirements of the job, that they have to do this. You have to now call them to account. You've got to put them on terms. You've got to institute disciplinary hearings against those senior managers who do not comply with those basics. So I suggest it's getting back to basics and just put measures in place to start, put these director generals on terms, and let's start at the top. Then I would suggest the culture of honesty and culture of integrity that you want to install will follow very soon once people get the message that if they don't comply, there will be consequences. So, Minister, that's really what I ask. Why have you not yet actually taken action against defaulting directors, generals, and other senior managers?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable William.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, my question is also directed to the Minister. First of all, the Minister, you talked about the environment as one of the, you could say, the points of the triangle, and that the current environment allows for corruption to grow. In fact, the current environment tolerates corruption. We need to start looking at how we can not only deal with people that don't submit their disclosure of interest, but we need to start identifying these individuals and isolating them into a very small environment that becomes uncomfortable for them. So, for instance, we should start seriously looking at lifestyle audits, and we should start with all members of parliament, all DGs, all HODs, and all CEOs of entities, so that the ones that are obviously corrupt or living beyond their means somehow will be identified, and then those people can be isolated and removed, because fundamentally, corruption in this country is, these corrupt individuals are acting in their own best interests and to the detriment of the state, and more importantly, to the detriment of the South African people. Now, the ANC is anti-corruption, we all know this, but we need to seriously start taking some serious action and identifying these people. I mean, or else this environment is just going to continue and nothing is going to happen. Thank you.
Thanks. Honourable Haile.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, if we check this page 7, it shows us that we won't have, if we don't take the PSC report seriously and act on them, we will always cry with corruption. Because if there are so many DGs who didn't sign, what about the people down where supply chain management and everybody? So we'll always have this irregular expenditures and everything. So what I wanted to check, Chair, is that with the Minister, after receiving this report, what is the department doing with this report? Because this thing, it makes the department's work easier, because they have where they should focus on what to correct and what to do on our challenges that we are facing. And I'm talking this, Chairperson, because I'm one of the people who still live in a gravel road with potholes, where we have tied with these potholes. And when we see such monies these monies with fruitless expenditures, it's shocking, Chairperson. So I want to check with the Minister, how are they taking this report seriously to end this corruption? We can do all the units and everything, but if we leave these DGs to do these things, Changanvare Matasano Fele Noveni, to be soft, you'll die in the bush.
Thanks, Honorable Maduleke. Honorable Bikani, and then I can see Honorable Ramatlakane, you'll follow.
Thank you, Chair. I take it that you're asking both the Minister and the Public Service Commission, but most of my answers I think would be expected from the Minister, unfortunately. Chair, based on the Public Service Commission's report, based their first report on the principles and values of the Chapter 10 for Public Service and Administration. Now, one of those principles, which is Principle 6, I think, that concerns accountability. They talk about an effective accountability system that is needed for implementation, particularly in DPSA. Now, I'd like to know, because the President has started off with signing performance agreements with ministers. Now, there's an issue where performance agreements or some form of intergovernmental protocols, I think, are supposed to be signed with premiers. How far is that process? Is it taking, is the process that has started? Is it holding water, or is it just still talk? Because I believe that if this is supposed to be, this performance agreement thing is supposed to become effective, it must start at the top going down. And all steps must be closed off to ensure that there's equal accountability held by all members of state. In the process of the performances in provinces, I take it that under human resource management, in directorates and departments, there should be an office or a desk, I don't know what to call it, for performance management systems. Now, these guys are supposed to be professionals on their own. Who are they? Where are they? What's happening with these guys? Because you don't hear much about them. And it's one major area of office that, if properly applied or implemented, the processes are properly implemented, you'd actually be able to see the significance of the presentation that you just had from the Public Service Commission in terms of compliance to disclosures. Now, one of the issues that came out is that there's still a trend of submissions not coming in on time. The percentages are fairly low. Instead of going up in improving, we see that 2009-10 is at 46%. Now, my question in relation to that is, what sanctions are attached to help processes of improvement in timelier submission of those performance appraisals? Because I think the people in those offices are also senior managers whose performance themselves should actually be assessed, but you hardly hear anything about them. Then, Chair, when I look at my dear province, the Free State, in one of the graphs, on the 31st of May, we can see that there was the 19% submissions of disclosures. And then I'm just wondering if it's a realistic percentage, is the true reflection of the 86% as of 31 October 2010. And if it is, my interest is as to what was applied or what was implemented, or rather what was done correctly to ensure that improvement. Because out of what was done correctly is what we should be stressing here for application for the rest of the departments to ensure that next year is even better, or we work towards the 100% compliance rate expected. Then, Chair, I'm just wondering if our induction and educational programs, especially when public servants take office, are effective. Because a lot of this information would really require some study that we have. And for us to apply sanctions we must also cover our side, especially within the public service, to ensure that people are properly inducted. I'm just wondering what type of induction programs or training programs are being applied to make sure that when you do apply sanctions or when you do charge people for non-compliance, then you would know that they are fully informed, because sometimes some of these public servants come in and they don't have the proper knowledge of what they are supposed to do or what are they supposed to, what is expected of them in terms of issues related to disclosure of forms. And even there, including even members, there's very little I can note in terms of members being inducted or drawn into programs properly to understand the importance or the seriousness of disclosure of information. Then, Chair, let me pause there for a while. Thank you, Chair. Let me pause.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, and sorry that I didn't miss the Minister's intervention. So, you will forgive me if I take you back. I just want to ask this question. I mean, the issue around there is a program in government that is led by the President Anti-Corruption Program. And, of course, the Minister of Finance has also emphasized that issue quite all the time in the budget process. Now, what I want to understand, Chair, is that the who are we talking about really senior state officials here? It's not people that don't know what is happening. There are people who actually implement government programs, who are supposed to be leading from the front. Now, I just want to ask in this context, what has there ever been a consequence? A consequence for failure to comply? Driven by the executive, driven by national, in other words, from the minister downwards, has there been any consequence of failure to disclose? I mean, the handbook is very clear about the misconduct, what has to happen in the instances where people fail to comply. But what I don't know is whether the and I envy your task minister as a one person that has to receive this report and come to the committee and inability to do everything that we want you to do with it. But surely this should be a matter that the cabinet is also seized with, because all the director generals here, the ministers, the accounting executive authorities are all members of cabinet. Has they ever considered or at least look at the recommendations and the findings from Public Service Commission insofar as it affects those Director General, the Cabinet? Has he ever been able to say this can't happen because all ministers sit there? Now, and if, of course, what are the consequences there that is associated with that particular action? Because I think the issue, I mean, the AG finding report, we remember the 600 million, the issue of conflict with people in the department, that surely should send a signal and strong message that at the level of the executive cabinet, they should really hold the handle and create the web around this. So that's my question around that particular question. And the second one probably goes to the commission. Have we ever taken time to actually drill down a little bit deeper in the issue that you raised at your last 3 points on the slide, to actually find that some of the things that have not been fully disclosed deliberately has something to do with what we're all fighting against, meaning the issue of corruption? Or can the commission be in the process to actually drill down on that sample cases to be able to come with something that you can say, this is what we find and this is now the consequences? I don't necessarily have a problem with the issue about lifestyle audit, but we must not look for solutions somewhere when the mechanism already exists right now that we are unable to implement those mechanisms to force compliance. So that's really the question I'm really asking, that because I shudder at fear that the continuation of this process or the problem of the disclosure and failure thereof by the senior state official must be sending a particular message to the head of government. If they can't do what he asked them to do, what must he do in terms of this? Can they be continuously trusted? Can they oversee the official below if they themselves are unable to do what is right? So I'm just really asking, because that's really a political question I'm asking, that it is no longer at the level, it has to be escalated to the level of executive. But has that been escalated to the level of executive, and what is the action associated with that escalation of the problem?
And lastly, Honourable Van Skalvig.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just very curious. What were the reasons for not submitting by the due date? Is it laziness? Is it just carelessness? I'm just curious about what are the reasons for not submitting by the due date?
Okay, thanks. I will allow the minister. Is there another hand? Where is the hand? No, you did ask a question. Okay. Honourable Vigani, Honourable Mahal, you want to? Honourable Vigani, proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, but sometimes it's difficult to collect your mind. I just have the one other issue is, for example, also as part of ensuring some issues of compliance and principles that are put in place by government is the Batlapele principles. Now, what I'd just like to know is in terms of synergy in matters of policy, because even now in the Constitution does state that 2A, that whatever is applied in the public service administration actually applies in all spheres of government. There's particular mention of all spheres of government. But you know for a fact that the Batlapele principles are mainly applicable within the public, within the provincial and national sectors of government. Now, what can be done to ensure that there is the vision of an integrated approach in terms of similar compliance within local governance in particular? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll allow the Public Service Commission and the Minister to respond. What is it, Honourable Robert Lakan? You want to add something?
Yes, actually, I could not read my handwriting at the time I was speaking. I wanted to ask the Minister the role played by the evaluation and monitoring with respect to this particular aspect, Minister Chavani, for an example. In terms of the process, in terms of the performance contract that the ministers have signed as well, is there a role that he play in enhancing the role that your ministry is playing in ensuring that everybody comply with the rules that has been set?
Let's start with Public Service Commission. Minister, you follow.
Thank you, Chairperson. There were a few questions that were directed to the Public Service Commission. One of those questions is the question of whether in the processing by the Public Service Commission of the 30% or drilling down, I think was the word that was used, whether there's been any questionable disclosure. I think that is a very important question, because it brings us back to the purpose, the very purpose of the framework, in fact. One will recall that the purpose of the framework is really to prevent and manage conflict of interest. I think one must say that upfront, that that is the purpose. So when the Public Service Commission, scrutinizes these forms, and as the DG was saying, we need to be scrutinizing all of them, in fact. Somewhere they should be scrutinized, somewhere somebody needs to be, their attention needs to be drawn to a potential conflict of interest if it exists. And measures must be taken to ensure that that actual conflict of interest is prevented. Now, in the 30%, and in the report that the Director General has promised in terms of that reporting, is the question that we pose to all those 30%, that should there be disclosures that have not been made, we ask the question whether disciplinary action has been taken against those managers that have not disclosed. And that is a very important aspect, and I think one of the questions and debates pointed to that. That this is important in the sense that where there's non-compliance, and then the other question is why there is no compliance. Now, the non-compliance can be attributed to a variety of problems that we have in the public service, from lack of supervision, from lack of responsibility from the managers that is concerned, from even lack of accountability, where the one manager will pass it back to the other when they say, no, I submitted them, and the other one says, no, you didn't, up to the office of the minister or executive authority, where it will be said, no, we did give to the office of the executive authority, and others say, no, you did not. So it's a variety of questions. But the point I'm making is that when everything is running smoothly, we should be achieving the 100%, because where the submissions have been made 100%, we're able to draw the attention of every senior manager to a possible conflict of interest and ensure that measures are taken to ensure that that does not translate into corruption. I think those are the two questions that offhand I can think of that we directed to the commission. That's fine.
Okay, Honorable Minister.
Thank you very much. I think to add to what the chairperson of the Public Service Commission has indicated, and again, modeling that around the disclosure management here in Parliament. The Ethics and Integrity Officer, or the officer to be based in DPSA, and of course in each department there has to be one in terms of the initiatives that were introduced, will then be in a position to make follow-up. As the chair has indicated, there will be a variety of reasons and stuff like that, some related to the personal circumstances of the individual concerned. You find that maybe somebody is off sick and stuff like that. Now, there is a follow-up. There is a follow-up that you remember as members of Parliament. Just before the deadline, each one of you will receive a reminder to then say you have not submitted your declaration. Please submit by this. I'm sure that practice is still there. Now, that is in terms of the, it may be to expect too much for the commission to do that at the moment. That's why we then see from a public service, it is a point of view, we then see this ethics and integrity officers, which each department, by the way, is going to designate one. It will then make it a point that you take charge of your situation. Now, following up and stuff, so you will even know, I mean, what each and every person's reason is for that. It's an attempt to actually strengthen what we have. Now, a question that says, we do have code of conduct, we have SMS handbook, we've got all these things. Why do we continue to write these and write that and stuff? Anything that we are writing is not meant to undermine what is existing, but it's actually meant to enforce. If you look at the integrity, ethics and integrity framework, what it does is to take two sets of codes of conduct, one at local government, one at national and provincial level, into one. Obviously, when you look at that, it then tells you that there are some areas of the code of conduct which need to be revisited because they are actually not tight enough to deal with these issues as then. But it also adds into one set the attributes that you expect from each public servant. We identified eight at the moment. We may actually talk about more depending on the feedback we receive from the public. But it does not end up there. It brings in the issue of the vertebrae principle. Now, so you then see from one, and not only just do that, but it is one thing, because it is one thing to have code of conduct on the one hand. But it's the other to actually enforce that. And how do you enforce that? How do you have some people violating your code of conduct every day, but when it comes to merit assessment, you have already forgotten about all that. Now, this issue is then to then say all your code of conduct are going to be with you, talking to who you are at all times, that your personal situation is actually put on the spotlight. So it's more to strengthen those issues. And of course, it is always given that codes and policies are subject to review, depending on the state effectiveness of such. You don't have a tool that even if it is blunt, because you have it, you don't sharpen it. That's a recipe for failure. And what we are doing, we appeal that people should look at it in terms of sharpening rather than any other thing. The tools are there. But if the tools don't deliver, you not only look at the tools, but you also look at the implementers, those who are responsible in terms of dealing with those things. But if the tool itself provides for some challenges, you need to address it. For instance, you know that when it comes to issues of discipline management, that is one of the areas where if you talk of a decentralized public administration, it's one of the indicators. Now, that's why you will find that you have public servants who may find themselves in breach of a code of conduct and the instrument, and they are put before disciplinary hearings. But you find that for the similar offense, from department to department, one is just receiving a written warning, the other one not even receiving a warning, maybe called to the manager's office and said, don't do it again. The other one, you find that action is taken, serious action is taken. So it's as if we don't have one public administration that subscribes to the values as we are supposed to have in terms of what the Constitution dictates that we should have. So we are then dealing with these issues to make sure. For instance, we will be talking about facilitating handling of cases in our administration where you have, even at the level of people, you can call your public service prosecutorial team to make sure that this decentralized practice of enforcing discipline is actually coordinated. So our appeal is that people should look at what we are doing as coordination mechanism for efficiency, for effectiveness. other than anything else. We are not actually repeating the things that are there. We are then saying, if we expect different results, we need to begin to do things differently at some stage. That's exactly why we are doing all those things. So it is true, it was necessary that an interministerial committee be established at the level of the executive, at the command of the president. So that you then see treasury when it comes to supply chain violation, public service, when it comes to general violation of public service restraints, all other departments, you need a central mechanism, because you write, honorable member, the one who said, you know, in cabinet, that's where all ministers are. You need a coordinated effort of dealing with this thing. So our understanding and our approach and the interventions we're introducing should be understood in that light, to make sure that, yes, it's true, we have got 34 departments at national level, we've got 9 times 10 departments at provincial level, and stuff like that. But that should not mean that each department itself represents government. So you can be saying you have a government of the Department of X and a government of the Department of Y that find themselves doing things differently. You need to have this approach where you actually deal with issues like that. On the discipline management, the end result of that, or the impact of that, is to fast track the finalization of cases. In dealing with the instrument of enforcing discipline, is to make sure that there is uniform in interpretation and application. That is exactly why we are coming with all these things. The question was that, Minister, why have you not taken action? Why have you not taken action? Here are the people. Well, before coming to that, there is an indication that it's not impossible to have 100% compliance in terms of submission. Of course, it's correct. It's correct. According to the PSC report, it shows that if the Western Cape, if the Northern Cape could do it, that they find themselves way above 90% with the Western Cape at 100. So it is possible. But what does it take? It takes management. There is no magic here. You just need to have management intervention to get things done. And it is possible, right from the top up to the lowest level, is just to have managers doing this. Where you don't have a public, it's not only management you should have, but you also need a political authority. Yes, you also need a political authority to actually enforce this thing. I like the question that the honorable member said. He was actually talking about a wish. I wish our department is not one of those performing below 50. I would like to then check, of course, the Public Service Commission may be able to do that, to break down this report from provinces into departments. You will be able to see a picture that is there. I can't say that there are holy cows anyway, but what I can say is that there is no space for holy cows, because we remove holiness and then you remain cows for all of you. Now if it is in DPSA Canaanos, if it is part of that, that is where I suspend my mind. And what remains is making sure that there has to be enforcement. We need to actually deal with those things. Now the question is, why have you not taken action? You know, things are like this. I think that question, if it's possible, could be revised, and then say, in this decentralized public service, where you don't have a super minister or super department, an intervention like we are bringing on board now, to look at coordinating the management of discipline should be something that all of us would then say is a step in the right direction. So instead of the question saying, why have you not? Because the answer is, did I have authority? And you can't answer a question with a question that is generally regarded as arrogant. And we actually don't believe in that. So the move that we're taking should actually be a reason for people to rally around this initiative. To them say, let's look at the situation where we actually will deal with the issue. All one wants to see is action. And of course, at our level, at the level of the political authority, the IMC is there to do exactly that. Because working in silos is one dealing with things that if I had not actually been transparent and reporting in a common arrangement becomes empty. That then comes to the point raised by Honorable Member Ramatlagan, the issue of the role of the performance monitoring and evaluation. Because the role of that ministry, amongst others, is to through performance monitoring, evaluation, identify if there are areas where there has to be improvement, if there is assistance that has to be given, but also if there is accountability that has to be given, we then have to look at that. The IMC is actually leading at that level and coordinated at that ministry. So when it comes to dealing with the issue of corruption, it becomes very important. Well, the environment, don't remember, the environment itself tolerates corruption. If it does tolerate corruption, it is for us to look at the environment and then what are the indicators of this environment that it is so corruption tolerant, and what is it that we actually have to address. That is exactly why we introduced the concept of the triangle. To them, then, when we talk about corruption, let's not only look at the corruptees. Let us not only look at the corruptors, but let us also look at the environment, and let us actually remove that environment. We can actually deal with these issues through a lot of interventions. I'm not sure if lifestyle audit. I'm not schooled, you know. I'm not an authority to the concept. I'm not sure exactly what it means. If it's unpacked for me, I may actually deal with that, because if I use my own understanding, it's a lifestyle audit. You are saying you want to conduct an audit on the lifestyle of other people. Are you going to do that for everybody? Are you going to respond to the prevalence of indicators in a person's conduct? This suggests that you need to be subjected to the lifestyle audit instrument. I'm not sure exactly the question I at some stage may have to unpack as to what to mean. But suppose that lifestyle audit, and I'm putting in suppose, like I actually give the disclaimer. Suppose in lifestyle audit, we want to make sure that people don't find themselves in strategic positions that places them closer to areas of decision making that in turn benefit them. So that's why they will actually be in fact. The question is, don't we have in our public service at the moment the instrument that deal with this thing? Now, if for instance you then say you want to then say, hey, look, we see you now, you have changed your hairstyle, and we suspect now you have changed your salon, you're not going to the cheaper one. It means you're going to the more expensive one. Then we must subject you to a lifestyle audit. It's a concept we might want to look at. If it would be helpful to deal with these issues, it would be fine. But for me, what we are doing as government is that we're putting instruments in place. Putting instruments in place to make sure that the three legs of the triangle of corruption are broken, so that we don't have such. I think we need to work together in terms of this. Now, what is the department doing and what is it going to do after receiving this report of the Public Service Commission? What are you going to do, Minister Valot? Again, let me use the triangle to respond to this question. And I'll talk about two legs of the triangle. I won't talk about the third leg, but maybe I should. The triangle I'm talking about is the triangle of the organs of the state of South Africa and the role they have in fighting corruption, amongst other things. And that is Parliament, that's the executive, and that is the judiciary. Whose instrument is the Public Service Commission? Is the Public Service Commission the instrument of the Department of Public Service and Administration? Whose instrument is that? Now, if we know the answer, then we'll then direct that question to say, what are you doing after receiving this report? The Public Service Commission is an independent institution created in terms of Chapter 10 of the Constitution to deal with issues of public administration. But in public administration, it's not only the executive that's a player. In public administration, it's Parliament that's a player. In public administration, it's the judiciary that's a player. Now, for issues related to the question that we're dealing with today, let me answer that question and then invite the partners to join in answering it. The Department of Public Service and Administration, as a facilitator in the project of good governance, we actually came with an arrangement where that we submit report to the executive. It's a new arrangement. We submit report to cabinet in terms of the report of the Public Service Commission. We have assigned the deputy minister to be directly involved in dealing with tracking the report of the Public Service Commission, working closely with the Public Service Commission, reporting to the minister, report to cabinet, and then say, this is what is happening. This is how the picture looks like. So that at the executive level, we will see them, then cabinet them say, no, this is exactly what we do. So that is what we do on our part. But who else should do what? Who else is our partner? It's Parliament. Parliament has a responsibility, and the Public Service Commission is more an instrument of Parliament. It's a shared resource, but it's more an instrument of Parliament. So this report, having received a report like that, this portfolio committee has a right to address anyone, any department, any province that is found wanting in terms of performance when it comes to this point. So we are doing our bit. It's necessary for Parliament to also come on board. I'm raising this as responding to the question without suggesting that Parliament is not doing that. But we need to definitely do something about it. Somebody asked to them, say, it looks like the Public Service Commission does not have teeth. And because they will investigate, they will have findings, and they will write reports, and people will not do anything, so it means it does not have teeth. And one tried to explain, and I agree with that person, tried to explain, you know, to say, no, the Public Service Commission does have teeth. It's just a special set of teeth, you see. one third of the seats reside with parliament. The other third of the seats reside with the executive. Now, these are the, you will know that it takes a force of a grinding between the teeth for chewing to take place. If in the upper teeth that move in an attempt to chew, the lower teeth are not moving. You'll realize that there will be no chewing taking place. There will be no grinding. So then the teeth are there. What then happens is if the battery is flat, for any of the institutions that have responsibility to ensure there is mobility in the teeth so that grinding and chewing can be completed, let's recharge our batteries. But let's get this teeth moving. Here's a report. The executive does what it does. Parliament also should do what it has to do. The Public Service Commission will be a respected institution in this country. It will actually live up to that. That's my answer to that question. Now, the question of the performance agreement, the intergovernmental protocols, how effective are they? Yes? No. My time. The anticipation is that the outcome-based performance that was introduced is meant to assist. You will all remember that this is the approach decided upon by the current administration and under President Zuma. So then say we need to sign performance agreement. Moving forward, we'll sign a delivery agreement and, of course, intergovernmental protocols to take on board the provinces. We are at a point now, for instance, the Minister of Public Service and Administration is the custodian of outcome 12 that deals with effective, efficient, and development-oriented public service. And of course, questions of empowered citizenship. Now, the delivery agreement has been signed with 8 departments and with 8 other ministers, plus all 9 premiers. So that when we talk about effective and efficient governance, we are looking at it across the board, up to provinces. Now, on performance management system, the question was, where are these officers responsible for performance management system? Who are they? Where are they? And stuff like that. I just want to share here, mindful of time and the speed at which I go, I just want to suggest that we commit ourselves to do a presentation to the portfolio committee on the application of the instrument called Performance Management Watch. Because we designed this instrument, which actually tracks performance guided by 17 principles. I may not recite all of them. I have them here in the interest of time. But it will be very interesting because if you zoom this instrument, it gives you a national picture, it gives you a provincial picture in terms of how our departments are performing. So if we may provide a space, of course, as one of the priorities for our engagement next year, we'll be in a position to talk about this. Has there ever been any person where we see the consequence for failure? Obviously, I think we may actually talk about that. That is a situation we may provide a report in as far as that is concerned. But the introduction of the unit that I spoke about is to make sure that with this coordinated effort, you make sure that in time you will be in a position to know exactly as to what sanction was meted out in which department for what transgression. There were to be the principles integrated. Well, that is actually something we need to do. At the moment, if you look in terms of it's true that the Public Service Act will talk about the environment of provincial and national and not go up to the level of a local government. That's why policies that are decided upon an applicable at provincial and national level may not necessarily be a penetrating down to local government level. But if we look at the provision of Chapter 10 of the Constitution, Section 195, you talk about the values of public administration. Those values that are there enshrined, according to that chapter of the Constitution, will tell you that those values are applicable across the sphere, which means provincial, national, and up to local government level, including, of course, our state-owned enterprises. So we may actually deal with those issues. Of course, there was to be the revitalization program. I mean, cascading was to be. There has been a program run at DPSA level, referred to as cascading was to be up to local government level. So it is actually attainable. But the conclusion of the discussion on the single public service, which is one of the outstanding issues we need to finalize, will then actually not end up in a situation where you just have to work on the cascading, but it will actually become like a practice that it is just there. I think that's my response, and thanks to colleagues for questions. But let's go back, sharpen our teeth, recharge our bases, get our teeth in movement. There is no chewing if our teeth are stable and the Public Service Commission will bite.
Okay, thanks, Minister. In fact, we still have another presentation that is going to follow from the Auditor General of South Africa's office. It would have been good if we just combined the presentation and made the discussion. But in the light of what we have discussed currently, I think we are noting as this committee in Parliament that according to compliance with financial disclosure framework, the report of 2009 to 2010 financial year, there had been non-compliance noted by Parliament. That's a serious matter when you talk about corruption. And that's non-compliance in terms of the country. It's 17%. And also, there had been late submissions, and that amounts to ill discipline. You know, what the framework is there, it's available, and, you know, it's to our interest to comply with small basic things. You know, basic compliance is required, even before we deal with bigger issues of where we've lost huge tender monies in tendering procedures, in tenders, etc. But basic issues such as just compliance, because it's there, there's a compliance with financial disclosure framework that government has provided. If we can miss that or take that line, we can be defeated in terms of dealing with anti-corruption. And therefore, for us as Parliament, it's a serious matter. And therefore, what we're going to actually send as a statement, particularly to the department that we oversee, Public Service and Administration Portfolio Committee, we're going to say, Minister, the 17% where the country did not comply, it's a matter of concern for us. And we are putting forward to you, we want a thorough response why this compliance did not happen. And we therefore cannot accept that even if it's a small figure, it means because it's not so huge, you can be able to deal with 17%. There is also 23% in the national department. You know, of course, working with NCOP would look at the entire 17% because it involves the provinces. But in terms
of also looking into the national department, the immediate oversight. There's a 23%, which as Parliament, as this portfolio committee, as we already had this session, would really need a thorough response in terms of what happened, where that non-compliance was realized, non-compliance at all, and also late submissions would really need to thoroughly clean up that area so that moving forward we don't have it at all. We've seen, of course, there was 100 complaints in Western Cape. We do want a situation like that, and it starts with basic things such as this one. Honourable members, you had a long day, ladies and gentlemen. I think I'll afford you a 10-minute break so that you come back to the Auditor General of South Africa's presentation. Break. You want to say something?
You're against that, but I think also we should add as a factor from the committee side that some of the issues here are the in-between issues that are not getting us to be at a rate that you'd like to see performance against anti-corruption practices. So some of these issues need to be, there is a feeling of being a bit relaxed, to be honest. There's a lot of issues that are too lax and have been dragging for too long, because it's not the first time we get such a report. So if the department, if they could treat this as a matter of urgency, what you summarized, Chair, treat it as a matter of urgency and more so with speed, because the grey areas we are noting are the very areas that are not making us move. That's all I think I should say for now. Thanks.
Gentlemen, it's not just to respond like one thing to the exactly, we'll definitely want to do that. But also, we need to be very specific in terms of what is it that we're asking. It's like giving an instruction to a person. If you want a person to jump, you need to indicate, please jump. So that it's not a question of like saying move, because the move may be to the opposite direction of where you expect that person. We definitely would like a situation where we then say, this report, if it is an old report, where are we actually talking about that? And what has been done since and stuff? I think we need a follow-up in terms of dealing with this thing. I'm putting it on record so that it comes out very clear that let's get a sense of the instructions we're giving. Thanks.
Honorable William?
Thanks, Chairperson. Minister, perhaps what we really want to know is, when will these reports just indicate 100% compliance, 100% everywhere? That's what we want to know. I mean, can you tell us? This time next year, we can come here, we can all sip on fruit juice and congratulate each other for 100% compliance across the sector. I mean,
I think, comrades, my understanding is that from this report, there is a marked improvement from the previous percentage to where we are. Secondly, because yes, if you check all the reports on the previous 3rd November to where we are now, and secondly, there is a response that says we need to sharpen our own tools here. But thirdly, fourthly, the minister said, there's a further clarity that will be made on the report in terms of, if you want to say name and shame, those departments that did not perform or are not complying. I think for that, for me, gives us that there is a willingness and there is a movement forward by the department. The question of also the time frames, I think in a way, are attached to what we want to achieve. So for me, ladies and gentlemen, I think that suffices. Thank you.
Okay. Maybe in conclusion, it's true, yes, there is improvement. You know, in order for the other teeth to grind, we don't need improvement, we need compliance. That's what you are saying as Parliament. You know, yes, improvement is there. For us, it's not an issue about improvement. Yes, we can see the figure, but we want to deal with the figure so that in future, people don't even have a 17% of non-compliance. We don't want it. Yes, of course, besides the improvement. So we are actually sharpening the other teeth. for grinding in our role for oversight minister. We don't need any non-compliance at all, because that's a framework. It's straightforward. It can be complied to. As much as I appreciate progress, but surely in grinding we want 100% compliance, and we think it's possible. I think on that note, Minister, can we then have to break? We'll come back to Auditor General.
Yeah, can I put it on record very clearly that the introduction of the anti-corruption unit, the review of the ethics and integrity management that the Department of Public Service and Administration is introducing is meant to exactly deal with this thing. I've indicated that we are introducing ethics officers who are not there. And these ethics officers, they will be following up. Come next year when we deal with the very same situation. See, when we ask to them, say, this is the report that is there, we should also be in a position to answer the question that one honorable member then indicated, what are the reasons for falling? Because in each department, we'll expect them to follow up on delays in submission. That is exactly what we are doing. That's why I'm then saying, as we round up, it will be very clear that it's not as if nothing is being done. Thanks.
Yeah, quite clearly, yeah. That's where we are. 10 minutes break.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we have a